Welcome to the Marketplace Roundtable podcast. We speak with Seeking Alpha Marketplace authors about their investing styles, their views on the market, and their favorite investing ideas. I'm your host, Nathaniel Baker. Before we begin, a short disclaimer. Seeking Alpha is a website where authors from around the world share their ideas and analysis on the stock market. The Marketplace is our platform for authors to run investing analysis and idea services so that readers can take their investing to the next level. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. A full set of disclosures will be provided at the end of this podcast. For reference purposes, this podcast was recorded on Thursday, November 7th, 2019. Today, I'm joined by a longtime contributor to SeekingAlpha.com, Eric Bass-Majan of EPB Macro Research. Eric has been active on Seeking Alpha since 2017 and an economic cycle analyst going back to 2014. He is the founder of EPB Macro Research, a premium research service here on Seeking Alpha, featuring a long-short model portfolio and a long-only model portfolio. A subscription to EPB Macro Research service gets you exclusive ideas, direct access to Eric, two model portfolios, a risk management system, as well as an economic cycle exposure reference guide. You can find out more on Seeking Alpha by searching for EPB Macro Research. That's E like Echo, P like Papa, B like Bravo. Macro Research. There is a free trial available. Eric and EPB Macro Research are also on Twitter if you're there at EPB Research. Okay, let's get into it. Eric, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
So it sounds like a pretty interesting macroeconomic cyclical, as your name suggests, approach to investing. What can you tell me about this a little bit more about your approach?
Sure. So our strategy and our research process is pretty straightforward. From a high level, we can separate the economy into two main phases, periods when growth is accelerating and periods when growth is decelerating. And what's nice about that approach is it's pretty objective. There's no opinion in an acceleration or a deceleration. It's more of a fact-based characterization. So when growth is decelerating, we have a defensive investment posture, which would include something like an overweight allocation to fixed income relative to equities. And the equities that we would hold are tilted defensive in nature. So things like utilities, healthcare, consumer staples, and real estate are your classic defensive sectors that we'd want to be tilted towards during periods of decelerating growth. When growth is accelerating, we'd do the opposite. We'd want to have an overweight allocation to stocks and risk assets relative to bonds, and the stocks that we do hold would be cyclical in nature or more risk sensitive. So it's very logical and it makes sense. You want to be defensive when growth is slowing, more aggressive when growth is accelerating. Now, wrap up quickly, in order to spot those inflection points or when you'd want to make your shift from the defensive to offensive, is where the economic cycle research comes in. And for that, we use a process of leading economic indicators. So we use a process of leading indicators to determine whether growth is going to accelerate or decelerate in the future, and then take the defensive or aggressive investment posture based on those leading indicators.
Okay, all of which begs the question, what status are we at now in this cycle based on your indicators and your research?
Sure. So just to give some context, I was last on a Seeking Alpha podcast in early May of 2019, or this year, and growth was in a phase of deceleration, and the leading indicators suggested that growth was going to continue to decelerate. And true to the investment style, our best ideas at that time were long-term bonds, utilities, and REITs. We also had a negative position on regional banks, which is a more cyclical exposure. And since that recording, long-term bonds up about 18%, inclusive of this latest drawdown. Utilities are up 10%, REITs are up 8%, all outperforming the S&P 500, which is something that we would expect during a deceleration in growth. So that brings us to today and where we're headed. The market is starting to try and shift to a phase of acceleration. We can see this over the last couple of weeks with a outperformance of cyclical exposures and an underperformance of defensives and a backup in interest rates. But the leading indicators are not showing such a rosy outlook, the same that's priced into risk assets. We still have an industrial slowdown that's going on, and that doesn't look like it's going to show a major inflection higher over the next several quarters. We're still going to have a persistent slowdown in the industrial side of the economy. And the risk of that, which is different than the prior few slowdowns we've had this cycle, is employment. So the leading indicators of employment that we have are actually moving to the lowest growth rate since 2009, which to us indicates that a loss of jobs, specifically in the manufacturing sector, is an active risk. And there are some bright spots in the economy, like housing has started to recover due to the decline in interest rates. But as long as there's this industrial slowdown that's putting employment at risk, we can't really sound the all clear sign on the economy, and we can't completely remove the risk of a recession from the forecast. So with all of that in mind, we'd still want to be tilted slightly defensive in nature.
So what would you say of the argument that the economy, especially the U.S. economy, is no longer reliant so much on manufacturing and much more service-oriented, and that for that reason, the manufacturing activity is really not as important as it once was?
Right. So that's a great question, and one that you get quite frequently.
Yeah.
So what we found is manufacturing is clearly a smaller and smaller share of total output. But when we look at growth, we're looking for the rate of change or the acceleration or deceleration in the rate of growth. And our study finds that when manufacturing activity is decelerating, even though it's a smaller share of the economy, it's so cyclical and so volatile that it still does pull the rate of change of total growth. So we've had a manufacturing slowdown that everyone acknowledges. Some people even call it a manufacturing recession, which I'm not totally keen on. But the growth rate of the total economy has slowed pretty dramatically. We've gone from a year-over-year growth rate in real GDP from 3.2% to 2%. So that slowdown that came primarily from manufacturing is still very important. Furthermore, what I think the most important thing is we ran an analysis that showed what was the correlation between manufacturing payrolls and total payrolls. So like you said, people would make the argument that manufacturing is a smaller share of the economy. But if we look at the second derivative in manufacturing payrolls and total payrolls, there's still a, and you run a regression, the R squared is still 0.92. Meaning that if you have a persistent deceleration or contraction in manufacturing payrolls, it would be extremely unlikely to not have a commensurate deceleration in total payrolls growth. And we're seeing that play out. Manufacturing payrolls growth has slowed to 0.3% year over year. You know, notwithstanding the GM auto strike, over the next 6 months, the chances of manufacturing payrolls going negative on a year-over-year basis is extremely high. And we've already seen total payrolls growth slow from 1.9% to 1.3%. So manufacturing payrolls are still very highly correlated to total payrolls growth, even more so than construction. The R squared on the manufacturing payrolls versus total payrolls is way higher than construction payrolls or residential building payrolls. They're high value added jobs, high salaried jobs. So the data suggests that the manufacturing economy is still much more relevant than it seems that consensus wants to give credit.
Mm-hmm. Have you seen anything in your data that might indicate any type of resurgence in manufacturing in the U.S.? Based on, you know, these tariffs that we've had on China, and obviously
there's been a lot of talk about how manufacturing is moving or will be moving back to the U.S. Have you seen any indications
of
that?
No. The tariff situation is interesting. When we look at the economy, we tend to find events that coincide with these inflection points. So in late 2017, early 2018, we had this deceleration in global manufacturing growth, coincidentally at the same time that the trade war started. So the logical explanation was that the trade war caused the manufacturing slowdown. But when we look at leading indicators, we go as far back in the sequence of economic cycles as we can. And this manufacturing slowdown was baked into the cake long before the trade war even started. We were able to see the early signs of a manufacturing slowdown as in late 2017. So the trade war, I wouldn't make the argument that it's helped anything. It's probably hurt on the margin, but it's not the main driver of the slowdown. The market seems to be optimistic every time there's an easing of tensions, which, you know, is probably helpful on the margin, but there's no indication that solving the trade war or ramping up the trade war will change the manufacturing outlook in the U.S. economy.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk through some of your other indicators, the leading indicators? You touched on manufacturing. What are some other important ones that you track, and how are those trending right now?
Sure. So we categorize our leading indicators into three main categories. So we follow the economic sequence that has been in place for, you know, as long as free market-based economies have been there. You're always going to have a sequence of economic events. You know, to give a very, very easy example, building permits are almost always going to lead new construction. It's difficult to have a new project without a permit coming first. So when you look at the economic sequence, you can follow that. You can follow that all the way back to the earliest part. And we separate that into three main buckets, what we would call long leading indicators, short leading indicators, and then coincident indicators. Coincident indicators are what most people cite, things like retail sales, employment, consumption. And most people form a bullish or bearish thesis based on coincident data, which really doesn't give you an indication of where you're headed. It kind of tells you what happened last month. So as far as the long leading indicators, there are some signs that long leading indicators have stabilized. And a big reason for that is the shift from central bank tightening to central bank easing. So as central banks shifted from tightening to easing, we've seen money supply growth around the world went from a very, very, very severe contraction. It bottomed and it started to reaccelerate, albeit pretty mildly. As far as the short leading indicators, the industrial side of the economy is still weakening, but the housing sector is showing some pretty optimistic signs. The low interest rates are helping. So as we move into the coincident indicators, we have this divergence between housing improving and manufacturing slowing. But the analysis that we just talked about shows that manufacturing is still more sensitive, and the change in manufacturing payrolls will still have a larger impact than the change in construction-related payrolls. So while this divergence is going on, the market seems to be favoring the upturn we're seeing in housing. The risk is the industrial side of the economy with that employment slowdown. So we do have some bright spots. The bright spots are typically led by the interest rate sensitive sectors, but the manufacturing slowdown is still ongoing. And there is evidence that the manufacturing malaise has spread into the services sector with things like the non-manufacturing PMI slowing over the past 6 to 8 months. So, and when you look at commentary from these PMI reports, the growth rate in services employment is also decelerating. So there's been a broad-based slowdown in employment that's not just centered on manufacturing, but it's probably most concentrated right now in manufacturing.
But these PMIs they're below 50, but they're not quite into the areas that would make people concerned, are they yet?
Yeah, I would say that's fair. With any data point, we're always looking for the rate of change rather than the nominal level. Yeah. So above 50 or below 50 can give an indication, like you said, of contraction or expansion. But, you know, if a PMI was, you know, let's say 30 and then improved to 39 nominally looks like a terrible reading, but it's a rate of change improvement. So we've only had one tick higher in the ISM manufacturing PMI from something in the 47 range to just into the 48 range. So on the margin, that's better. We're not showing signs that we're going to start seeing, you know, 51, 52, 53. So the rate of change looks like it's still going to be under pressure. So that's more what we're considering is the rate of change in the growth rate.
Very interesting. Okay, Eric Basmajian, I want to ask you some more about this and specifically what it means for interest rates and global growth in the coming months. Somewhat of a surprisingly, in terms of everything that's happened or that's been happening recently in the markets, surprisingly a little bit bearish, I think, more bearish than I was expecting, I should say. But let's first pause and take a short break, and then we'll come right back. I am speaking with Eric Basmajian, who runs the EPB Macro Research Marketplace service here at Seeking Alpha. You can sign up for the service either by going to seekingalpha.com/marketplace and looking for EPB Macro Research, or by typing EPB Macro Research or typing Eric Basmajian into the site search bar at seekingalpha.com. Okay, Eric, welcome back. Let's continue with our discussion here. And you're speaking of the a little bit more concerning macroeconomic outlook that you've been picking up in your data. What does this mean now for interest rates? Obviously, the Fed is back in a bit of a loosening cycle, although they haven't really made any clear indications of what they're going to be doing over the next couple of meetings. But where does this leave interest rates and also global growth as we go forward here?
Sure. And just to clarify, I don't want the outlook for a deceleration in growth to be misconstrued as a short signal on the S&P 500. We're not short the S&P 500. We actually have a long position in the S&P 500. It's an underweight position, no question about it. But all we try and say is that when growth is decelerating, equities tend to perform worse on average than when growth is accelerating. And whenever growth is decelerating or getting closer to zero, by definition, the risk of a recession is rising. So all we do when growth is decelerating is shift more defensively. You know, we're not going out and shorting the S&P 500. But right. as it pertains to interest rates, we have seen a big shift in forward expectations. At one point in August, when recession fears were at their highest, the market was expecting, based on Fed funds futures, that the Fed funds rate was going to drop all the way to 0.7%, which was pretty severe. That was at the time, it was about six more rate cuts than we had. Today, the market has virtually priced out every rate cut over the next 2 years. The last I checked, the market's pricing in about 19 basis points of rate cuts in the next 2 years, which isn't even a full rate cut. With that said, we don't have clear signs that the economy is going to have a 2016-style recovery. Everyone seems to be going back to the most recent history and saying if we have an upturn in growth, it's going to be as powerful as the 2016-2017 upturn. We may have a reacceleration in growth, but right now the leading indicators are suggesting that if we do have that upturn, it's going to be quite anemic relative to how powerful the 2016 upturn is. So with that being said, for interest rates to rise and to stay up, we would need a pronounced upturn in either growth or inflation. And both of those things seem to be are still depressed relative to the leading indicators. So the last time I was on the show, we had a very bullish position in long-term bonds. And we still do have a bullish position in long-term bonds, albeit much less so than we did before. We actually reduced our position in long-term bonds by about 70% at the end of September, which was only about 3% from the all-time high in long-term bonds. And we shifted a lot of exposure to the short end of the curve because we believe that the risk reward has shifted much more favorably to the short end of the curve because the market has priced out basically every rate cut. So the downside would be the market has to start pricing in rate hikes, which seems to be unlikely given the last press conference from Powell, some of the signs of global growth, and the ongoing employment slowdown. So as far as interest rates, for them to rise and stay up, we need a sustained upturn in growth and inflation. That doesn't look like it's going to happen. So the risk reward on the short end of the curve is a lot better because if you have a recession, they're probably going to bring the front end down to zero. If you don't have a recession, there's still a chance that the Fed's going to continue to ease and lower rates to combat the industrial slowdown, the employment slowdown, and a separate issue, the repo issue that's been going on with problems with the liquidity. A lot of that would be eased as well by lowering the front end close to zero because it would change the FX hedging cost of international money trying to flow into our treasuries, which currently has a negative carry. So there are a lot of scenarios which could result in a lowering of the front end of the curve, even without a recession, which makes the outlook on the front end of the curve a little bit more of a positive risk reward profile relative to the long-term bonds at this point.
Okay, so it sounds like you're saying like they're probably the market is not giving enough credence to the possibility of further rate cuts. Is that a fair statement?
I think that's very fair. I think that the ongoing risk is that the employment slowdown, specifically in manufacturing, spreads to other sectors and results in more interest rate cuts than are currently being priced in. Mm-hmm. I think that's accurate.
Yeah. And we've been here before. I mean, as recently as November 2018, the market was prepared for 3 rate hikes this year, right?
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
Yeah, so things turn around.
We had 3 rate hikes. Some firms were even calling for 4 rate hikes in 2019 when, you know, to be quite frank, the leading indicators at that point were pointed straight down.
Yeah.
So, there can be a big change in expectations. And something that we wrote about a couple weeks ago is there can be big changes in expectations within a trend. You know, the last slowdown was from 2015 to 2016, and the long-term bonds from I believe it was the end of 2014 to the latest low in interest rates in 2016, long-term bonds rose almost 80% during that slowdown. But within that 80% move, there was a 25% pullback in long-term bonds. So, you know, there can be radical shifts in expectations where if you don't have a firm process of measuring the cycle or some way that you can maintain your conviction through large swings in asset prices, that's a scenario where you could have probably gotten shaken out of a position that otherwise would have been very profitable given the direction of growth. So to your point, there can be huge swings in expectations in the short term. And I think that, you know, this year, the last few years, more so than ever, with the president tweeting about the stock market every day and trade headlines, the short-term reactions can cause asset prices to move closer to the extremes within these longer-term trends.
Interesting. Okay. What is there something that is particularly concerning right now about markets or about your portfolio? I guess one question might be that if you're at all concerned that there could be more of a more dramatic melt up than maybe you're positioned for. Is that something that you think about?
Yeah, I think in the short term, the constant to the extent that the trade war headlines continue to fuel short squeezes and, you know, a risk, you know, one of the risks that we're seeing now is we had a persistent decline in inflation and inflation expectations. And that was evident in long-term bond yields falling from the inflation vector. And what we're seeing now is we track both exchange-traded commodities, things like copper and aluminum, but we also track non-exchange-traded commodities, things that, you know, don't spike on trade headlines because there's no short position and there's no futures contracts. So the latest round of trade optimism has caused a really significant move higher in a lot of exchange-traded commodities. But the non-exchange traded commodities are less than 1% from their cyclical lows. And that divergence is causing a risk because market participants or investors who are much more focused on market signals or market prices are starting to look at these exchange traded commodities and say, we've changed trend. It looks like a bullish trend in commodities now, which is fueling some movement into cyclical stocks, more so than we're currently positioned for. As of right now, we're still viewing that as a short-term move because it's not being confirmed by non-exchange traded commodities. And if there was a significant move higher in growth or inflation that was going to cause a rise in commodities, you'd see it in both exchange traded and non-exchange traded if it was real demand and not just speculation. So I think a risk is that sentiment surrounding factors that aren't as cyclical, more idiosyncratic risks in trade headlines and tweets, cause distortions in market-based signals in the short term that will cause a lot of people to change their positioning without really a large change in the fundamentals. You know, so we've seen a big rise in the stock market over the past couple of weeks, a big move to cyclicals. But there really hasn't been much of a change in the fundamentals. So the short-term moves are certainly more extreme than they have been in the past, and that can cause a big risk for short-term performance if that's something that you're going for.
Yeah, just out of curiosity, what are the non-traded commodities? I thought everything had a futures contract these days.
So things like burlap and wool tops and copper scrap and aluminum scrap and things like that, very specific industrial commodities. A lot of times they're paired up with exchange traded commodities. So you'll see, you know, I think there's rubber in there, hides, cloth, you know, all kinds of things like that that are very industrially sensitive. That if there was a major upturn, you would see it there. And those commodities actually tend to be short leading. They would fall into the short leading basket. So just to give a context, in November of 2015 is when this non-exchange traded basket bottomed. And by April of 2016, this index of commodities has risen 15% roughly. You know, before the bottom in interest rates in 2016 and before the bottom in stocks. Today, we're seeing that same basket is virtually at its lows, and there's a growing divergence. Something I actually talked about inside the chat room with a member this morning was the growing divergence between the exchange traded and non-exchange traded commodities. Historically, that divergence resolves itself in favor of the non-exchange traded commodities more often than not. It doesn't mean it will this time, but to have the highest degree of conviction that we're going to have either an upturn in growth or inflation, you would likely see that in both exchange and non-exchange traded.
Is that not a proxy for China industrial activity, a lot of those gauges?
Yeah, absolutely. And the industrial sector is one of the last industries that's highly synchronized on a global basis. It's really difficult to see a upturn in U.S. manufacturing, but a downturn in Chinese manufacturing. You know, the whole manufacturing sector of the global economy tends to accelerate and decelerate together. So the 2016 boom in U.S. manufacturing was almost entirely related to massive stimulus in China. So sure, it's definitely a proxy on Chinese industrial activity, but has a large impact over global industrial activity.
Very interesting. Okay. Where else does this leave us now as far as investing and allocations? Are there any, I guess, investments that you would recommend as we look forward here towards the rest of 2019, which is really not all that much. It's another month and a half. And then we have 2020. What do you think should do well?
Sure. So as we get closer to 2020 and mid-2020, there is a chance based on assuming the employment slowdown doesn't derail the recovery. Based on the shift from monetary tightening to easing, there's a lag effect that comes in. And if the employment slowdown doesn't get too severe, that there's going to be a moderation of some of this industrial activity in 2020. At that point, you'd want to be out of the defensives most likely and more into your cyclical assets. But until we get there, we do have the employment slowdown and the industrial slowdown to navigate. Mm-hmm. And the most asymmetric investment that I see at this time is the short end of the curve. You know, you could express that in a lot of different ways through short-term treasury futures, euro dollars, a lot of different things, or most basically just through short-term treasury ETFs. IEI, SHY are short-term treasury ETFs that would benefit from interest rates or the Fed cutting rates more than the market expects at this point, which basically the market has pushed expectations to an extreme again, where they're expecting virtually no rate hikes over the next 2 years. So if you're of the opinion that we're going to get 1, 2, 3, 4 more rate hikes, rate cuts, there's still a lot of money to be made on the short end of the curve. You know, those ETFs don't move as much as some people would expect. You know, you may be able to see 5, 6, 7% gains in some of the short-term treasury ETFs. But on a risk-adjusted basis, those returns are quite favorable. If you want more juice, you can play them through, you know, treasury futures and other things like that. But as of right now, the short end of the curve looks to be favorable from a risk-reward standpoint. Your downside is you'd have to see either a real breakout or inflation, or the Fed start to signal that they're going to hike rates, which at this point seems extremely premature.
Yeah. To your point, the SHY, which is, it's not the shortest end of the curve, but it's the iShares 1 to 3 year treasury bond ETF, which is kind of used as a proxy.
And the IEI ETF, some people would call that intermediate term. I believe it's 3 to 7 years. The effective duration, I think, is under 5 years, though.
Yeah. Okay. But if you look at the SHY, to your point, like it had its highs in August, September, right when expectations of a recession were at their highest at the time. Then it was trading around 85. It's now dropped down to looks like in the below into the 84s. So there could potentially be some upside there, and obviously you get a yield with that.
Right, all the bond ETFs are looked at on total return. Absolutely, so you're still getting your yield on the short end of the curve, and you know if the ETF backs up on a total return basis, you still could come out ahead.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. Any other favorite ideas that you have other than it sounds like the short end of the curve trading maybe?
Short end of the curve. We're still tilted defensive in nature versus cyclical. We still want to stay away from, even though they've had a nice rebound here, we still want to stay away from the industrials, the materials, the earnings expectations for Q4, despite stocks going up, are continuing to come down. We foresee that continuing because of the ongoing industrial slowdown. We don't think that industrial stocks and material stocks are going to be able to post accelerating rates of earnings. So it's not a direct long idea, but we still want to be cautious on your really cyclical stocks and still tilted more towards the defensives. I mean, even if you just have a benchmark exposure to the S&P 500, you still think that's a safer play than jumping the gun on some cyclical stocks. You know, these cycles that we talk about, these accelerations and decelerations in growth, they last about 1.5 to 1.8 years on average. We're talking about many quarters in a row. So there's often not a rush to catch the exact low in any of these inflection points. You know, it would be great if you could always catch the low, but we actually did a back test that shows when you pivot from cyclicals to defensives, even if you're 3 months late at every turning point, you actually still end up outperforming the benchmark exposure. So we're not rushing into the cyclicals yet. If the leading indicators start to turn higher and we see in 2020 that there's going to be a more pronounced upturn, we'd have no problem shifting into those cyclical assets. We have nothing against them. It's just at this point, though, that seems premature. So for now, we're still tucked on the short end of the curve, still tilted, slightly defensive, still underweight equities. And we've had that position basically since January of 2018, which has resulted in some outperformance on a risk-adjusted basis over basically all the benchmarks that we are against.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting and a nice way of closing. I've been speaking with Eric Basmajian, who runs the EPP Macro Research Marketplace Service here at Seeking Alpha. You can sign up for EPP Macro Research either by going to seekingalpha.com/marketplace and looking for EPB Macro Research, or by typing EPB Macro Research or Eric Basmajian into the site search bar at seekingalpha.com. You can, of course, also follow Eric on seekingalpha.com and enjoy his free content there. If you have been enjoying this Seeking Alpha Marketplace Roundtable podcast, and I sincerely hope you have been, you can subscribe through iTunes, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and anywhere else you find podcasts, pretty much, simply by searching for Marketplace Roundtable. You can give reviews on those platforms to help other investors discover this podcast. Lastly, on the disclosures, Nathaniel Baker, I don't have any positions in any of the securities that we mentioned today. What about you, Eric?
So we still have a long position in SHV, which would be a cash proxy, SHY, IEI, very, very small position in long-term bonds still. Like I said, that's about 70% of what we had. So that's TLT and EDV. We have an underweight position in SPY, a position in XLU, and a small short position in KRE. We also have a small position in GLD.
Okay, GLD. Yeah, we didn't talk about gold at all, but that's okay. There's always next time. Awesome. For next time. On that note, thank you all for listening, and we look forward to speaking to you next time.